to appeal with them to not get involved with the legalists and their legalism and their law. And so it's a very strong personal appeal. So he first of all, here at verse number 8, describes again their problem. Remember, he did that back in chapter 1. Now he does it here again. He says, however, at that time, as unbelievers, when you did not know God, you were slaves to those who by nature are no gods. Now, we know that the Greeks and the Romans had a pantheon of gods, as well as you had emperor worship tossed in there. Every now and then you had an emperor that believed that he was God, and there was an annual observance to the emperor that you would go into one of the emperor's temples, and you would take a little bit of oil and you would pour it out, and that would be your annual homage to the emperor if you were involved in that. And most people kind of just went along with the emperor. If the emperor said, I am not only the emperor of Rome, I am God, they would go, yeah, whatever. And they kind of move on from that. I mean, I don't think anybody believed it except maybe the emperor himself. But they did have emperor worship. And they also had all these other gods. And really by this time in both Greek and Roman society, these gods, well, they were not really believed. I mean, it was more of a tradition that they had and following these gods. And in some places, it was a good excuse for a party. I mean, if you were involved in the cult of Dionysus or Bacchus, you would use that as an excuse to go and have pretty wild parties and orgies and all that. And of course, the Corinthian believers that we have studied on other times, that really, they didn't believe in the gods that they worshiped, but they just believed that it was a good excuse for a good party and a lot of debauchery. And so there were all these gods, there were all these temples. Really, if you go to Greece or to Rome today, if you go to even Western Turkey, you'll be able to visit many of the ancient temples of these gods. But Paul says, really, they are not gods at all. Prior to believing in Christ, the Galatians were slaves, not only to sin, not only to law, but also to their supposed gods. And in these heathen religious practices, as with cults and pagan religions today, holy days and their observances were very important. As I said, with the emperor, there was the emperor's day. Sunday, by the way, was seen as the emperor's day. And so when a Roman would go and do his annual pouring out of the oil at the emperor's temple, it would always be on the first day of the week. As the Greek says, the Kyrios Kai, the Lord's day, but not the Lord as we know it. That was the Lord Emperor. That was how that particular day got its name. And so they would observe days, and then they would observe feasts within these pagan religions. Every one of these gods and mighty men who were worshipped, they would all have their holy days. And so this is something that these people were familiar with, so they were slaves to that. They were slaves not only to sin, as are all believers, they were slaves also to law. And they were also slaves to their pagan religious practices. Now, Paul, what's interesting is he's going to draw a connection between the holy day observances of paganism and the observances of holy days according to the legalists, which were founded in the Mosaic Law. In doing this, he compares the legitimate Old Testament holy days of Israel's dispensation with pagan holidays. That's rather interesting. I mean, he's taking something which was legitimate at one time and now compares it to pagan holidays. And in doing that, he really compares what was once a part of God's law and what is a part of God's word with satanic and pagan practices. And we really can glean a principle from that, and that is that just because God gives something doesn't mean that man will be infallible in its use. Also, just because God gives something in one dispensation does not mean it is valid in another dispensation, and it can even be used for evil in another dispensation. Where do the legalists get their legalism? Mostly out of the Old Testament law, which was a legitimate law for the nation of Israel, not a law for spirituality, not a law for sanctification, not a law for salvation. But it was a legitimate law for the people who were living within the borders of the nation of Israel. It was their constitution. And it was legitimate for them. But for people to take it today in this dispensation, the dispensation of the church, and use it as a means of spirituality, in other words, you'll be more holy if you don't eat pork, that's taking something that was given by God in one dispensation and using it in another, and it becomes an evil principle. It becomes an evil principle. And so what's interesting, in the Old Testament dispensation, people were to worship God on the seventh day of the week, on the Sabbath. And, of course, you have people today that want to be seventh day this and seventh day that. It's interesting, before moving here to the Midwest and then my brief time in the South in Hope, Arkansas, I had never heard of Seventh-day Baptist. I had never heard of Free Will Baptist. I never heard of a Baptist that didn't believe in eternal security, and I found out that there are such an animal here in the Bible Belt. And then there were Seventh-day Baptists who think that we should worship on the seventh day, on Saturday. So I guess they use Saturday as their day of worship. So, again, looking at something which was legitimate in one dispensation, which was keeping the Sabbath, bringing it into this dispensation, it becomes an evil principle of legalism. And, of course, it's funny because some of those who worship on Saturday, they would say that by us coming together on the Kyrios Key, the Lord's Day, because it is the Lord, the Emperor, not the Lord Jesus Christ, but because they say we're worshiping on a Sunday, we are involved in evil. I actually had one person one time tell me, if you go to church on Sunday, you're really worshiping Satan. I thought, oh, yeah. What? We've taken the mark of the beast by worshiping. Boy, that's a stretch, isn't it? Oh, my. You know, I of course, being a student of church history, you sit there and say, well, gee, that means all those post-apostolic fathers in the second century, all those apologists and teachers of the word in the third, fourth century, the great theologians like Augustine, all those guys all the way through the time they discovered this, they were all involved in satanic worship. Calvin and the Reformation and Luther and Zwingli and later on John Knox and on, they were all involved in evil. Because all those guys from the first century onward, you have historical evidence, they worshiped on a Sunday. And you even have biblical evidence of it too. In 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about when they gathered together on the first day of the week. John was in Revelation chapter 1 on the island of Patmos, worshiping God on a Sunday on the first day of the week, and repeatedly throughout the scriptures. So very strange things. But that's just an example of how you can take something that's legitimate in one dispensation, bring it into another, and it becomes evil. And then those same people will turn around and say that others who understand grace are evil. So just because God gives something doesn't mean that man will be infallible in his use of it. We have, for an example, the local church. There are some which could be compared to a pagan system of demonic worship. In Revelation chapter 17, the great whore of the tribulation is a church. It is a church. It is a religious organization. It might not be a church. It could be a mosque. But it is definitely religion. And so you have churches, for example, in Revelation 2 and 3, which are good churches, a couple of them, and a lot of them that are really in error. And so just because God gives something doesn't mean that man will not distort it. Paul sees nothing wrong with comparing Old Testament law applied at the wrong time, the wrong place, the wrong way with a pagan demonic system. We could look at this in terms of what's in a name. What's name? So just because somebody slaps church on the front of a building doesn't mean it's really a church. If it's misused, if it's abused, the name means nothing. In Matthew 24:5, Jesus even said, "For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am Christ,' and shall deceive many." So even if somebody comes along and says, "Well, I am Christ," or "I am this," or "I am that," doesn't mean anything. You know, the proof is in the fruit. Verse number 9. But now you have come to know God. And I've always loved the way Paul puts this. He says, you have come to know God. He says, but rather, he said, let me be a little clear on this. Let me explain this. Rather to be known by God. That's really more important. And somebody says, do you know God? Well, yes, but what's really important, does God know me? Does God know me? Yes. And as believers, God knows us. He says, but now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, How is it that you have turned back again to the weak and worthless elemental things to which you desire to be enslaved all over again? Boy, this is really Paul really cutting them down. They should by now be maturing enough to know God, but they don't. They don't. Instead, they are known by God because they are believers, but the relationship is really not mutual. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 5, it's the unbeliever who does not know God, whereas later in 1 John chapter 4, 2, verse 2, chapter 5, verse 19, the believer, you and I, we are to know God. And so the unbeliever does not know God. We are to know God. And Paul says, now that you've come to the point where you know God, well, maybe you really don't. But God knows you. You are a believer. But by your acts, it certainly is evident that you don't know God. Remember, it is your view of God that determines really everything in the Christian life. It is how you view God. What kind of God do you have? Do you have a God that you have to run from? Carl and I have been talking, we were talking yesterday about the fear of God. A lot of people don't understand the fear of God. Remember I told you a few weeks ago that from what I see in the Old Testament, especially whenever a person feared God, they were drawn to Him, not pushed away from Him. Normally, if you fear something, you're going to run from it. You're going to avoid it. You know, if I'm walking along in a dark alley in the wrong part of town at night and all of a sudden some guy jumps out in front of me and says, "What are you doing here?" I'm heading the other way because I'm afraid. So fear normally drives us away, but our fear of God is a fear that draws us to Him because we know Him, we understand Him, because it is our view of God. What kind of view of God do we have? A God that, yes, we may fear Him because He is sovereign and awesome and omnipotent in power, and He is the creator of the universe, but that should draw us to Him, not push us away from Him, if we have a correct view of God. But most people don't. Most people don't. They have a view of God that God is a God to be feared and to be avoided. Just He does His thing and I'll do mine. Or God, their view of God is that God is a God that demands works. And if we don't have perfect obedience and perfect works, then He's going to just take every opportunity there is to whack us over the head. You know, to give us discipline or punishment. That's their view of God. And so people, it's the view of God. These people, well, they were known by God, but they didn't know God. And so now they think, well, if I go out and observe this holy day, if I do this work, it's going to impress God. Is that our view of God? That we can do things to impress Him? The only one that God has ever been impressed with was His own Son, when His own Son came to earth, lived a sinless life, went to the cross, died, and on the third day rose again from the dead. He was impressed with that. You know, you just think about God the Father looking down at God the Son and going, "Wow, that's impressive. That's impressive." He doesn't look at us and go, "Wow, that's impressive." Sometimes I think He looks at us and says, "That's depressive." But we have a view of God that where we know God is a God of grace. And so even if we understand that, it's grace and faith. And if I understand that, then I think, wait a minute, going and observing someday a holy day, does that add anything to God? Does that add anything to Him? You know, even Job understood that by the end of the book of Job. You know, 4,000 years ago, you cannot add to who God is. You can't impress Him. God says, "Where were you when I created the heavens and the earth?" He wasn't around. You know, He wasn't there. And so, can we impress God? No. But we should be drawn to Him. Furthermore, they think they are going off into something new. This keeping of the holy days, according to the Jewish calendar, was something that was new to them. And so they think, well, this is new. This is novel. This is a part of this new religion that we're embracing. But it's really just the same old paganism, thinking one day is holier than the other. And of course, it was Paul in Romans who said some people regard one day above another as being important. Others regard all the days as the same. Let each man be convicted in his own soul. In other words, so if you as an individual want to, and you should have, at least one day off a week, take a day of rest, take a day of relaxation. If you want to have a Sabbath on a Wednesday, that's fine. A Sabbath is a day of rest. you know, that's fine. That's between you and the Lord. But don't think it's some law. Don't think it's something that every believer should do. One of the worst things we have in legalism is one person finds out that something works for them, like quiet time. You know, they find that getting up in the morning and having an hour quiet, half hour quiet time with the Lord is just helping their spiritual life. They then come to believe that that's the panacea for all believers, that every believer should do that. That all believers, and if you are not getting up and having a half an hour quiet time in the morning, you're not spiritual. And that type of arrogance promotes a lot of legalism. And so people, if you decide something works for you, if you like getting up early in the morning and having quiet time with the Lord, well, as they say down under, good on you. Good on you. That's good for you. That little idiom basically says that's good for you, and I'm glad for you, but don't try to tell me that I'm to do that. Good on you, not on me. You know, so whatever you find out, if you find something in your spiritual life works, you're a believer priest. And as a believer priest, you might find something that works. Now, you take a pastor that finds something that is good for their own life, and all of a sudden they have the bully pulpit in a way to be able to promote that. Oh, brothers and sisters, my Christian life just completely changed once I started to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. And most of you know me. Yeah, right. Uh-huh. Get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and have my quiet time with the Lord. And you need to do that too. And if you're not doing it, you'll never be as spiritual as me, type of thing. And so that's how legalism gets promoted. And maybe the pastor did find that that was good for him. You know, I would think that God isn't even awake at 5 o'clock in the morning, man. I mean, you know, and I know he doesn't want to see me at 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, so. But, you know, that's the way legalism is promoted. Now, we saw the word elements that's used again here in verse number 9, back in verse number 3. And we observed that it was the Greek word stoicheia. A little bit more on this word. It was used as a measuring rod or ruler. And thus it is the world standard or measuring rod. It's not God's. Furthermore, it is a weak and poor measuring rod. In other words, imagine this, you guys that have done any building, that you have a tape measure that's, let's just say, a half inch off for every foot. You know, instead of being 12 inches, every foot is divided. It's divided up, has all the right lines on everything else, but it's actually only 11 and a half inches long. Well, you're going to have some problems when you start building, aren't you, Bruce? You're going to have some real problems, and especially if you're using one tape on one side, another tape on the other side. I remember when I built my garage up at the lake, Carl and I had to do some extra work on the roof trusses, had to add a few pieces. It worked out fine. It was very strong. But we were measuring back from one side and putting a mark to put the truss on. And the people on the other side were measuring back and putting a mark. The problem was, is we were putting our mark on that side of the 2x4, and on the other side they were putting it on that side of the 2x4. So all my trusses through it are exactly 1.5 inch off all the way down. Well, when we went to sheet it with the 4x8 sheets, it was like, these are not fitting right. Well, you add a 2x4, just scab a 2x4 onto that, and they fit just fine. As I said, it ended up without a problem. But it made me realize that, you know, you can have mismeasurement. Well, imagine if you were building with a tape measure that was off and other people were using a tape measure that was on. It wouldn't work. It wouldn't work. And that's what the standard of the world is, that standard of good and evil, that standard that says in the world, if I do good, I will be rewarded, and if I do bad, I will be punished. And that is the way the world thinks. And that is the way most people think about religion. That's the way most people think about Christianity. And Paul says it is a weak and poor measuring rod. In Colossians 2:8, he says, see to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the traditions of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ. So we see there that these elementary principles are in opposition to the standard that is according to Christ. And then later in Colossians 2:20, if you have died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, why, as if you were living in the world, do you submit yourself to decrees? Here in Galatians, we could say, submit yourself to these holy days. Verse number 10, here is what they were doing. Here's what they were doing. It hits the problem. You observe days and months and seasons and years. You observe days and months and seasons and years. Now, these days, months, and seasons and years are part of the Jewish religious calendar. They were feasts and holy days of Israel, and they were given as a part of the Old Testament law, and they had a twofold purpose. First of all, they were given as the law, as a part of the law, and required by the law for religious observance. This was part of holding the lid on the nation of Israel, requiring them to participate in these religious observances. Remember, Paul earlier in Galatians 3 said, why then the law? It was given because of transgression. And we said that we could expand that to say it was given to hold the lid on the nation of Israel, hold them together as a people. If they had not been given that law that came from God at Mount Sinai, they would have gone into the Holy Land, been there for maybe a couple hundred years, and been pretty well assimilated into the peoples, the Canaanites, the Philistines, all those who were already there. And so they were given a law, and the law held the lid on the nation until the promise, Jesus Christ, could come. And so the holy days are part of that. As a nation, they were to observe the Sabbath. As a nation, they were to observe these holy days as a continual reminder of their relationship with God. And then secondly, each holy day and feast or fast was a type of Christ, which looked ahead to the Messiah who was to come. And so also there was a predictive nature of these holy days, that as they observed Passover, they might be looking back, but they would also be looking ahead. Let's just look at these. I forgot that one line there. Okay. So each holy day and feast was a type of Christ that looked ahead to the Messiah who was to come. Let's go ahead and look at six of the Old Testament holy days and how they did look ahead to Christ. First of all, number one, you have Passover. That's one that we are most familiar with. This looked back, of course, to the deliverance from Egyptian bondage when the angel of death passed over those who had placed blood upon the doorpost and the lintels. But, of course, it also looked ahead to Messiah's deliverance, when the Messiah would come and deliver them from the bondage of sin. So it was rooted in a historical event, but also looked ahead to when Christ would come and deliver from the slave market of sin, how they would be delivered from the bondage of sin. And so Passover looked ahead to Christ. And then secondly, you have Pentecost. This was the feast of the first harvest. When you go to Israel, if you go there in the wintertime, like I did in January, you will see the fields are very green. And that is because they grow winter wheat in Israel. The climate is perfect for it, especially in the Galilee. And so you have all these green fields. And, of course, the harvest then comes in the spring. And this was Pentecost, probably equivalent to the first of our June, late spring, early summer. And so this was the feast of the first harvest, and this looks ahead to the Messiah, Jesus Christ, supplying all of our needs, supplying all of our needs. There was always plenty to eat at Pentecost. You know, along through the winter, they might have to ration their food, be a little careful with what they have. But boy, once this time of the year hit, they had plenty to eat. And so this was a picture of the Lord Jesus Christ supplying all of our needs. Then you skip over to the fall, and there was the Day of Atonement. We know of it as Yom Kippur. This was the national day of sacrifice for sins. And, of course, this looks directly ahead to the once-and-for-all sacrifice of Christ on the cross. And so, very specifically, it looks ahead to Jesus Christ going to the cross and being the once-and-for-all sacrifice for sins. And that is observed in the fall. Then there was also, number four, the Feast of Tabernacles. I've always liked that feast. There's some who believe that Jesus Christ was actually born during the Feast of Tabernacles. And that looked at fellowship and growth in doctrine, which would be provided through Christ. Tabernacles was really a week-long celebration. And the people would move out of their houses and live in booths or tents, hence the name Tabernacle. That word tabernacle means a tent. And so imagine you in your house. I got a big backyard. And let's say that I'm in my house, but for the Feast of Tabernacles, I go out and back and pitch a tent and live in the tent. And of course, all food was prepared beforehand, and so you're eating your K rations and all that, you know, and your meals ready to eat, your MREs, and you got everything. So you're out there, and you're in your tent, and so all the normal things that you were involved in, all the busyness of being in your house and the busyness of work and everything else, that was canceled for 1 week. And so it was a time of intense fellowship and learning of the Word of God. Peace of Tabernacles, I could describe like as a week-long Bible class or a Bible conference. Or it could be described as camp, when you go to camp. And you're there in the hills of Arkansas or wherever, and you're just concentrating on the Lord for a whole week. And so that looks ahead to a time of fellowship and growth in doctrine, which we should continue all the time, and we certainly have that provided through Jesus Christ, who went to the cross. Then number five, there's dedication or Hanukkah. And that celebrates the restoration of the temple and looks ahead to believers, you and I, being the temple of God in this age. And so whereas before there was a physical temple, now all believers are the temple of God. And then number six, there was the Feast of Lots of Purim, and that celebrated God's protection of Israel. That comes out of the story of the book of Esther and what happened during that time. And that looks at the protection of Israel and looked ahead to God's protection of every believer. Now, the principle that we have with these is that once the object of the celebration has come, there is no need to continue to celebrate looking ahead to the fulfillment of the celebration. It has already occurred. If a woman is with child, she's pregnant, you might say to her, well, you know, I'm looking forward to you having your babies. We'll put that in the plural since we have Amy who's going to have babies. And so you say, I'm looking forward to that. Well, after they're born, you wouldn't say, well, how's the pregnancy going? I'm looking forward to your babies being born. It's like, wait a minute, they're already here. They're keeping us up all night. They're driving us crazy, you know. So, that can happen with kids, you know. What they say, insanity is inherited from your children. You have that. You wouldn't look ahead to that. Another example. And when the Jews come together for Passover every year, when they have their Passover meal, which is, of course, a very celebratory meal, what is the last thing that is said of all Jews throughout the world at the end of the Passover? Next year in Jerusalem. Who doesn't say that, though? What Jews do not say that? Exactly. The ones that are in Jerusalem. They don't say that at the end of... They're already there. Why would they say, next year in Jerusalem? Somebody would say, Moshe, I hate to tell you this, but you're here. You're already here in Jerusalem. Okay. So there's one group that wouldn't say it. Because why? They've already fulfilled that expectation, that prediction. And the same way, once with all these feasts, once the object of the celebration has come, there's no need to continue to celebrate looking ahead to the fulfillment of the celebration. Now, some have used this verse that talks about you observe days and months and seasons and years as a legalism. It's amazing that, you know, let's look at that verse. We have on our eyes of grace and our ears of grace. We have ears to hear, and those are the ears of grace. And we're looking at this through grace, and we say, you observe days and months and seasons and years. And we read it in context, and we know that he's talking about those who have taken upon themselves to observe holy days, thinking that they would be spiritual. So we see this verse as a tremendous testimony to grace. Okay, now I'm going to ask you to do something that's kind of hard to do. At least I hope it's hard for you to do. And that is take off those eyes and close those ears of grace and put on the eyes and the ears of law. And look at this, just verse 10, out of context, you observe days and months and seasons and years. What legalism could you get out of this? It's illegal to have a calendar. Boy, that's an extreme, isn't it? Yeah, there you go. Good, Kevin. You have a calendar? Well, haven't you ever read Galatians 4:10? You're observing days and months and years. How about your birthday? I got one of those coming up sometime in a few days. And a birthday, you celebrate, you observe a birthday. Don't you know what it says in Galatians 4:10? You observe days. And you even said it, birthday. Oh, you're evil. You know, how about Christmas? How about Easter? You know people that would tell you it's wrong to celebrate Christmas. I'm not talking about the liberals who want to get Christ out. I'm talking about other Christians who are legalists that will say, you know, you have a Christmas. Somebody just a few years back, I talked about Christmas and said something about our Christmas tree. And they said, you're a pastor and you have a Christmas tree in your house? Don't you know? You know, there's a passage in Jeremiah that says, you know, people go out in the forest and cut down a tree and they bring it in and they bow down before it and worship it. Well, first of all, I went to Walmart and got mine. And I don't bow down before it and worship it. You know. But don't you know how terrible that is? You're observing a pagan holiday. Don't you know the roots of that? That's rooted in Druidism. Yeah, I know that. I know that. Oh, and pity the poor Christian that allows their children to dress up at Halloween. Oh, my. You know, somebody said, don't you know that's Satan's birthday? You should say, no, it's Dan Hill's birthday.
Ooh. What can we draw from that?
Well, I just figured that all you guys are doing that. Pat and I walked into a costume store the other day, and we looked in there, and there's all these costumes there. That's the first thing I walked in. I looked in, and I said, look, all this just for my birthday. Like, can you believe it's just for my birthday? No. Yeah, they did. Yeah. We won't describe that one. But you see how you get legalism out of that? Just put on your different eyes. Put on your different ears. What you see and what you hear. If you go at that verse with law and works, you're going to be just saying, we can't ask. And you know that there's Christians, there's religions, there's churches that do that. You can't observe a birthday. You can't observe anything like Christmas or the Day of the Resurrection, Easter. You can't do that. You cannot celebrate that. If you celebrate that, you're evil. You're evil. And they use verses like this to get that legalism. And so Paul, it just depends on how you look at it. And the context, you know what he's talking about. He's talking about Galatian believers who were starting to observe Jewish holidays as a method, as a means of spirituality. And so we have that as a problem today. But these people who use this verse incorrectly, they completely miss the point. The legalist today who tries to say by not observing any holiday or birthday, etc., is more spiritual than those who do, is just as guilty, not as the Galatians, as the legalists, as the Judaizers who were attempting to bring their legalism into this wonderful Gentile believing community. Now, this is where I mentioned earlier, Paul gets really personal. He makes a personal appeal at verse number 11. Paul says, I fear for you that perhaps I have labored over you in vain. I fear for you. Paul fears because he knows that this observance of holy days is just a first step down the road of more legalistic enslavement. I fear the direction in which you are going. You know, I've been pastoring now. I've been ordained since 1973, and I've pastored for quite a while. And I've, of course, encountered many people over the years. And there are some times that I have had people say something to me, and it just strikes fear into my heart. Because I begin to see the road that they are going down. They're taking the first steps on that path towards more and more legalism, more and more heresy. You know, sometimes it's just a statement. And I go, uh-oh. You know, man, that's a step in the wrong direction. In the wrong direction. And quite often it has to do with some type of legalism. And you can see that. And this is what Paul was seeing. This wasn't just, you know, he wasn't seeing this as just something, oh, yeah, we just decided, you know, we wanted to have a few parties during the year. You realize these would be fun. You know, let's just go ahead and observe these holy days. Why not? I mean, it's not hurting anybody, is it? I mean, getting together for Passover, for Tabernacles, for Pentecost, it's not hurting anybody. You know, observing these, you know, why don't we observe the Jewish calendar? I mean, after all, it's such a great illustration. The whole thing illustrates Christ. And in many ways, if we were to look at the Jewish calendar of holy days in another way, we would actually see how it outlines for us the complete course of history. is almost outlined with all the holy days. That's another complete study, but we can see that. And we're right between Pentecost and Tabernacles right now in the church age. That was the longest gap you had between any of the holy days, and that really is like a picture of the church age, if you put them all together. So, what's wrong with observing that? Paul says to these Galatian believers, what you are doing is striking fear into my heart. The word fear is the present middle indicative of phobia, where we get the word phobia. He means he keeps on fearing for them, and his fear is beneficial. This is a fear that in part is motivating Paul to write this letter. We can see that nothing will strike fear into the heart of a communicator of doctrine quicker than seeing his students, his sheep, teetering on the edge of reversionism, legalism, or the opposite, lawlessness and sin. And Paul is fearing for them. He says that perhaps I have labored over you in vain. And here we see Paul, the pastor, greatly concerned over his sheep. Often the criticism is leveled at pastors that they're too hard, they're too abrasive, they teach too intellectually, they're too dogmatic. And we know the Apostle Paul was that at times. He was that way at times. But just like Paul, every pastor is also a pastor and often puts himself in the place of his people. And he fears for them. He can see the outcome of their thinking. Most pastors have been around long enough to see where this is going to go. And I've seen it here. I've seen people that were just so strong in their attendance to Bible class, and they really wanted to learn the Word, and pretty soon things begin tapering off, and I kind of move in at that point, and I talk to them, and I say, you know, I encourage them to come to class, to be steady, and being a part of this local church, as most of you who are here this morning are. And they listen, and pretty soon, well, I'm busy with this, I'm busy with that, and it becomes less and less and less, and pretty soon they're gone. You know, I saw that way back at the beginning. I saw that. And some of you do, too. Some of you kind of see that. And it happens. It happens. And so you begin to see the outcome of their actions and their thinking. Somebody says something, and again, it's like, uh-oh, they're heading down a path. They're heading down a road that's wrong. And often, sometimes when a person says things to me, I mean, you know, as I said earlier, Carl and I were talking about the fear of the Lord. Okay, we're back on now. Okay, let me just go ahead and finish this point. It's about time for us to end anyway, and then I do have a couple of announcements. So just like as a parent, you know, you who have raised children, if as a parent you have ever hurt for your child as you see them doing something, you say, uh-oh, I see where this is going. You know, the first time your child looks at you and you ask them to do something or you say something to them and they go, no, uh-oh, that's a sign. It's almost too late. You know, children should never say no to their parents unless that is the anticipated response. So when you see that, you begin to hurt for your child. That's the same way a shepherd over a flock begins to hurt in that sense. The word vain means without cause or to no purpose. And so Paul says, I'm fearing that my labor with you there in Galatia, when I spent time with you there, has been in vain. Look at the first words of verse 12. That's what we'll begin with next Wednesday night. I beg of you. And people, that word is not, it's not beseech. It's not ask. He really is. He is deomai. begging of them to become as I am, for I also have become as you are. You have done me no wrong. We'll pick it up at that part of the personal appeal on Wednesday night. Now, let's go ahead and pray, and then we have a couple of announcements I want to share with you. Father, we thank you for our time spent together this morning in your word. We ask now that as you dismiss us, that we would be dismissed to a time of fellowship and preparation for the privilege we have to worship you in spirit and in truth. Okay. Amen. Thank you.